Baseball season is heating up. Odyssey has you covered with the most entertaining coverage of your team. Stay locked in and in the know with the local voices you trust as they bring you unfiltered takes, recap games, react to the latest team news, and talk to callers. Listen to your favorite shows for free on the Odyssey app, odyssey.com, your smart speaker, or in the car with Android Auto or Apple CarPlay.
A lot going on in Russia over the weekend as the Wagner Group, a Russian paramilitary force led by Yevgeny Prigozhin, made its way towards Moscow, and it looked like we might have a coup. Now, a deal was struck by the president of Belarus between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Prigozhin, and it looks like Russia will drop charges against the Wagner Group, but a lot of questions remain about Putin's strength and concerning the narrative and his invasion of Ukraine after the uprising by the Wagner Group. And to give us more information about what's exactly going on right now is Krister Knapp. He's the professor of U.S. intellectual history and conflict and security studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Knapp, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on, Amy.
Well, it's a bit confusing, everything that's been going on in Russia with the Wagner Group. My first question is, where does it stand with the Wagner Group in Russia and Prigozhin? Is he in Belarus?
Latest reports are that he has arrived by plane in Belarus just within the last few hours.
And Putin will, as long as Prigozhin stays in Belarus, Putin, who has called him now a traitor, he will not go after him in any other way, presumably?
Right.
Right. The skepticism you hear, I would echo that. Look, I don't think that Prigozhin has much of a future here, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, up until this past year and more recently, the Wagner Group had been the most effective fighting force in eastern Ukraine. But he was already sustaining heavy losses and was weakened due to the fighting in Bakhmut. And then that's when he really began his criticisms of Shoigu, who's the defense minister for Russia, and went public with those criticisms. And they became increasingly vicious. And it was already showing that Prigozhin was already losing his credibility and his ability to fight effectively. If you look at the situation in Ukraine, you see that Prigozhin is out. Defense Minister Shoigu remains in. He's in power, and he continues to have Putin's support. Prigozhin has lost that support, right? If you look at the regular Russian army troops, they are there. They are doing most of the fighting. They will continue to do most of the fighting. Russia remains in a defensive posture in occupied eastern Ukraine. They've got dragon's teeth and mines and trenches and tripwires, and they're going to try to prevent Ukraine's advance. While Wagner was primarily an offensive special force and thus not really, you know, part of Russia's current defensive strategy. And most of Russia's offensive capabilities are long-range missiles and artillery against Ukrainian cities, which, again, is not really part of the Wagner portfolio. So there's really not much of a battle future for Wagner, and certainly not for Prigozhin, who will likely be the subject of a GRU special unit that will probably try to assassinate him, as Putin has sent out this unit to use Novichok, which is a deadly nerve agent. And so I don't see much future for Prigozhin.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And it seems as though, excuse me, that Putin has also opened up another front in the war. What would that be? His own people. The guy who's been controlling the media in Russia for so long had to come out and essentially say, hey, there's a military coup that's happening here. We must stand against it. These traitors, these terrorists need to be dealt with. He's got a delicate balancing act of not only continuing his war in Ukraine, but also trying to find some way to show the people of Russia that he's in charge.
No doubt about it. And, you know, it's an excellent point. And Amy mentioned an important word earlier, which was narrative. And what Putin is trying to do here is control the narrative. And so he's thrown out, he's referenced the 1917 Russian Revolution. He's talked about civil war being averted. He's talked about tyranny and traitors and so forth. And the narrative he's really trying to show is that it is traitors like Prigozhin who are a danger to the stability of the state, to Russia, and of course to Putin himself. And what he wants to do is to project power to counter that, to show that actually everything is okay. But if you scratch the surface of the narrative, you realize there's actually something deeper going on, which is often the case with these authoritarians. What I suggest is really going on here is that Putin has empowered groups like the Wagner Group, which is really a private military company that acts as a paramilitary organization. And there are at least a half a dozen of them operating in Russia and in Syria and Libya and in different states in Africa. And they've really been sort of Putin's go-to groups when he wants to get things done to project power and shore up Russia's security interests. He used the Wagner Group in the initial invasion of Ukraine back in 2014, and he's really relied on Prigozhin and Wagner ever since. But the challenge he has now is that these groups rose up against him. And so I think what's really going on underneath is that he lost control of the very special forces, the paramilitaries, I should say, that he's needed to get things done. And so he wants to change the narrative away from his loss of control to him being in control by pointing the finger at Prigozhin.
Yeah, and that's where I had some confusion just with who has the authority in a group like the Wagner Group and how Putin, who said he was going to issue a cease to exist to the Wagner Group on July 17th, that group would be absorbed into the Russian military. How was he going to just usurp Prigozhin's power and do that?
So it's, again, another excellent observation, because it's always been an interesting question as to exactly what the chain of command is with these paramilitaries. Part of the reason why Prigozhin was able to challenge the defense minister in the Russian army was that he didn't answer to him. He wasn't in that chain of command. He answered to Putin. So there were two separate chains of command, and we know what happens when that situation occurs. So he could get away with that and get away with criticizing Shoigu as long as he had Putin backing him. But when he made his march up the highway, he scared Putin to the point where Putin thought, even if it wasn't true, he thought there really was going to be a civil war, that there was going to be a coup from within, a so-called elite or palace coup, even though Prigozhin is really not part of the inner elite. But in any event, so he's had a separate chain of command. So now the fear that these paramilitaries could represent threat to the Russian state and to security, they're going to have to disband them and reconstitute them in a way that they will answer more to the official chain of command.
Also, there was a video of Prigozhin when he was angry that the Russian military wasn't giving them their weapons. He used a word that was interpreted as volunteer, that these fighters were volunteering. I guess in my head, I thought they were hired, that they were getting paid. Were these fighters getting paid by the Russian military?
My understanding is that they are getting paid. So I know the video you're talking about. My understanding is they're getting paid by the Russian state, but again, not through the traditional Russian military command structure, right? It's sort of outside that. It's paramilitary. So they're not volunteers. I'm sure, you know, Prigozhin speaks with a lot of it's propaganda, mm-hmm. right? They're not volunteers. They're called that because he's recruited convicts and others from the margins of society to go and fight for a lot of his skilled fighters that have already been killed on the battlefield, which is part of the reason why he's not as effective as he once was.
Right. And yes, and you bring that up, that he was recruiting people for this group from penal colonies, from jails. And I know that he sold hot dogs. I know that he started a restaurant business, was an entrepreneur, became Putin's chef because he would do all this contract work for food. And then suddenly he's the head of the Wagner Group. And there's like a big hole in my knowledge of how did he make that jump from Putin's chef to the head of a paramilitary group?
Well, you're not the only one with some questions about that gap. And it's, you know, we can all look online, but it's not exactly clear as to all the things that he was doing. It's important to point out that he was never really an actual chef. He was always more of a contractor and a brokerer. He never cooked a meal for Putin. He hired other people to do that. Like many people that came out of the former Soviet Union after it collapsed in 1991, including Putin himself, there were a number of former Soviet officials that were looking for ways to leverage themselves and their position in society to gain power and access to the highest levels of Russian society. And Prigozhin was one of them. And the fact that he wound up working for Putin was a way for him to leverage his own power to the point where he was clearly able to get things done behind the scenes. And it seems pretty clear to me, and I think other Russia watchers, that it is Putin that empowered Prigozhin for that ability to get things done that would allow him to run a paramilitary. But he himself, to the best of my knowledge, doesn't have a particularly great deal of military experience.
So when he takes off to go to Moscow and then eventually winds up in Belarus, he vacated a lot of property that he was moving forward with in Ukraine. Have the Ukrainians taken advantage of this, and have they seized back most of that land?
So, as you know, from the same reports that, you know, that I've seen, is that the Ukrainian offensive is moving. It's slow. I saw something like 50 square miles. I could be mistaken in that. And I think 9 villages in the first couple of weeks here. I don't know if they've taken back exactly the same land that he's vacated. But if he was the only one that was, you know, sort of putting up the real fight and resistance in Bakhmut, it would stand to reason that over time the Ukrainians are likely to take that. But it's very hard to get accurate information about what exactly is going on the battlefield from the Ukrainian perspective, because they're actually quite they keep that quite close. They're guarded about that.
Seeing this uprising from Prigozhin made me wonder again, what would happen if something were to happen to Putin, or someone were to take him out, or whatever it may be? Because it feels like there wouldn't be someone else taking up the mantle for his mission to restore the USSR or whatever it may be, because he's this monomaniacal pseudo-imperial autocrat who's driven with this one mission. Would there be someone else who perhaps would take Putin's spot, but also not have the same drive to continue the invasion of Ukraine?
Yeah, another great question. And you put your finger really on one of the key debates that go on among scholars and analysts about Russia and Putin. Is this all Putin, or is this Russia, or is it some of both? I tend to fall somewhere in that latter category. I don't think Putin is operating alone here. He has the backing of a state. Now, I should tell you, there is a formal process. Should something happen to him for one reason or another, there's a formal process. There is a vice president. Nobody knows his name, but there is a vice president that would ascend to the presidency. And they do have a prime minister that's in charge of domestic policy. So they have constitutional means to deal with this at a formal level. But that doesn't really answer our question. The deeper concern here is what would happen to the center of power in Russia. And I think it's important to realize here is that Putin is backed by a lot of individuals inside the Kremlin and the military and the security services who are all, to use the Russian term, gusarosviniks. They're statists. They believe in the state. State above all else. And the state is there to preserve one thing and one thing only, and that is order. And Putin has seen himself as the top of that chain and to preserve the state to ensure order. And the long-term goal, you're right, is to restore a kind of Russian empire. It's not the Soviet Union per se, but kind of make Russia great again by expanding its borders and its reach. So it's very czarist in its origins in that sense, and Putin sees himself that way. But he's part of a larger system that he's helped create, but that also runs him as well, or that he works with. And so I think, you know, we have to be careful what we wish for. Putin might go away, but he could be replaced by someone who's equally committed to the state. Another Siloviki, as they're called, the securocrats.
Professor Knapp, before I let you go, along that line about someone else coming after Putin could be no better, but that someone else would also take control of Russia's nuclear arsenal. And that, I imagine, is something the U.S. is watching.
Oh, I'm sure they're watching it very, very carefully. And I'm sure they're also been listening to the conversations between Prigozhin and Putin and Lukashenko. because we have excellent signals capabilities. So I'm sure they know exactly what's going on. And obviously, nuclear weapons are always going to be the number one concern in these kinds of situations. The thing I would point out, as I would do for most of these kinds of dynamics, is to just remember the sort of, you know, the doctrine of mutual assured destruction. And, you know, any status that would take over for Putin would work with the same logic, that there would be no reason to use nuclear weapons because it would ensure their own demise. So, I've never been convinced that nuclear weapons are going to enter into the conflict with Ukraine. And I don't think the next Russian leader, whenever that happens, is going to change Russia's no first strike policy in that regard.
He is Professor Krister Knapp, Professor of U.S. Intellectual History and Conflict and Security Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Thank you so much, Professor Knapp, for your time and expertise this morning.
Thanks for having me on.
Baseball season is heating up. Odyssey has you covered with the most entertaining coverage of your team. Stay locked in and in the know with the local voices you trust as they bring you unfiltered takes, recap games, react to the latest team news, and talk to callers. Listen to your favorite shows for free on the Odyssey app, Odyssey.com, your smart speaker, or in the car with Android Auto or Apple CarPlay.